the headlines. Iran says a recent Israeli-U.S. declaration against Tehran is also aimed at securing Israel's hegemony over Islamic and Arab states. Palestinians stage a rally in the besieged Gaza Strip to voice their opposition to U.S. President Joe Biden's visit to the Israeli-occupied territories. And Italy is facing a political crisis as Prime Minister Mario Draghi tenders his resignation. Hello and welcome. Your world news coming to you live from our headquarters in Tehran. My name is Gisum Shahmadi. Iran says there will be no peace and stability in the West Asian region as long as protecting the security and superiority of Israel is a priority for the U.S. Iran's foreign ministry spokesman said Iran considers its neighbor's security as of its own security. He pointed to a recent declaration by Israeli and U.S. leaders of putting an anti-Iran stance on their agenda. He noted that the declaration is aimed at targeting not just Iran, but securing Israel's hegemony over Islamic and Arab states. The statement was signed during U.S. President Joe Biden's trip to Israel. Washington has reiterated that it remains committed to Israel's security, especially the regime's qualitative military edge in the region. Staying in Iran, a senior military commander says the United States will pay the price for using the phrase use of force against the country. Spokesman for the Iranian Armed Forces, Brigadier General Abulfazl Shekarchi, says that the use of that phrase is part of Washington's psychological warfare against Tehran. He advised the U.S. to review its previous failures, including the destruction of its Ain al-Assad military base in Iraq and its withdrawal from Afghanistan. He also said Washington is only trying to repair what he called its hollow grandeur and slow down the process of the collapse of the Israeli regime. During his latest visit to Israel, U.S. President Joe Biden said he is prepared to use force against Iran over its nuclear program. Biden made the comment during a meeting with the Israeli Prime Minister Yair Lapid. Saudi Arabia says it will allow all carriers to use its airspace if they meet the country's requirements for overflying. The kingdom says that the move aims to consolidate its position as a global hub connecting three continents. The decision would lift overflight restrictions on airlines traveling to and from Israel. The U.S. has praised the move, calling it the result of President Joe Biden's principled diplomacy with Riyadh. Saudi Arabia made the announcement hours before Biden's arrival from Israel on the second leg of its regional tour. Saudi Arabia's lifting of flight restrictions to Israel is seen as an apparent gesture of openness towards the regime. Back in 2020, several Arab states, including Bahrain and the UAE, normalized ties with Israel. Palestinians have rallied in the Gaza Strip to slam U.S. President Joe Biden's visit to the occupied territories. Biden has been expressing his full support for the Israeli regime since taking office. Ashraf Shannon has more.
Palestinians in the Gaza Strip have condemned U.S. President Joe Biden's visit to occupied Palestine. Scores of people in the blockaded enclave protested against Biden's visit while shouting slogans in support of resistance actions against the occupying regime. U.S. President Joe Biden arrived in Tel Aviv on Wednesday to kick off his first trip to the region since taking office. Palestinian resistance movement Hamas accused Joe Biden of putting the interests of the Israeli regime ahead of the legitimate rights of Palestinians and regional security.
The President of the United States of America carries nothing but unlimited support for the Zionist entity, its security and prosperity, and a package of false promises to the Palestinians. The United States' adoption of Zionist plans is based on uprooting our people from their land by force and obliterating their identity and history in favor of the Zionist entity.
During his trip to the occupied territories, Joe Biden visited U.S.-funded missile interception systems, including the so-called Iron Dome and Iron Beam. The Islamic Jihad movement says the U.S. administration only aims to prolong the Israeli occupation and support its aggression against the Palestinian people.
Joe Biden's visit comes to serve the interests of the Zionist entity, and he's not welcomed in our land. We believe that the U.S. and the Zionist regime share the same interests. Joe Biden has ignored the suffering of the Palestinian people and continues to support the Zionist regime.
Palestinians have warned against the dangers of Biden's agenda and the attempts to integrate the Israeli regime into the region and expand the circle of normalization with it. Analysts say that all U.S. administrations have adopted the same biased policy towards the Israeli regime.
When it comes to Israel and Israeli security, there is no difference at all between Republicans and Democrats. What we are witnessing today is that Democratic President Joe Biden's support for the deal of the century and his support for further normalization between Israel and the Arab countries.
Palestinians are calling on the free people of the world to reject the arrogance and policies of the United States that target the region's security and stability.
Observers say that Joe Biden's visit will only give the Israeli regime the green light to further violate the rights of the Palestinian people. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
Torrential rains continue to wreak havoc in several Indian states, killing nearly two dozen people and displacing millions more. The fresh deluge in Maharashtra state has caused riverbanks to burst and sewage to flood homes. Shops in many cities are closed while thousands of residents are evacuated. The Weather Department has issued a red alert for several districts. At least 18 people, including six children, have been killed in that state. Rains have also been lashing to Gandhi State for the past 6 days, where reservoirs are receiving heavy inflows. Several bodies, including those of two rescue personnel, have been found there. The floods have destroyed farmlands and interrupted communication. Extreme weather in India has become more frequent in recent years, which environmentalists blame on the climate change. Italy's Prime Minister Mario Draghi has offered his resignation after a rift with the Five Star Movement. President Sergio Mattarella has refused Draghi's resignation in a bid to overcome the political deadlock. Max Civilli reports.
On Wednesday, Italy's Prime Minister Mario Draghi announced his resignation at the end of a bruising day in which his executive survived a confidence vote on a cost of living bill in the Senate, with one of the biggest parties in the government alliance, the Five Star Movement, abstaining from voting. In a statement, Draghi said that the pact of trust at the base of the government's action and the conditions to carry out the executive's program no longer exist. However, President of the Republic Sergio Mattarella rejected Draghi's resignation in an attempt to break the political impasse, inviting the former European Central Bank president to address Parliament and to assess the situation.
I have already said that there won't be a second Draghi government. Let me say, this executive has dealt with the ongoing tensions pretty well.
The Five Star Movement pooled its support for the Draghi government over a bill aimed at helping businesses and households with skyrocketing energy prices and a provision for a trash incinerator in Rome, a project the once anti-establishment party staunchly opposes. The Mario Draghi government was formed after ex-Prime Minister Giuseppe Conte's second executive collapsed in February 2021. Draghi was appointed to address the consequences of the pandemic and to manage about 200 billion euros in grants and low-interest loans from the European Union for a radical restructuring of Italy's economy.
As usual, Draghi destroys the small and medium enterprises and destructure the economy rather than restructure it. The perspective is to transform the Italian economy in a weakened economy that will be a sort of ground for big multinational companies.
Italian President Mattarella takes on a central role now. It's up to him to decide whether to try to persuade outgoing Prime Minister Draghi to form another executive, find a new caretaker leader to take the country to an election next year, or call an early elections in September. October would be an unprecedented event in Italy's political history, as in the autumn, the government generally needs to prepare and pass its budget. Max Civili, Rome.
Sri Lanka's parliament has accepted the president's resignation 2 days after he fled the country following months-long protests. The president sent his resignation letter by email from Singapore on Thursday. The prime minister has been sworn in as the acting president until parliament elects an MP to succeed the president. The parliament speaker says that the process will take place quickly. Last week, protesters, angry at the spiraling economic crisis, stormed the president's residence and office in Colombo. They blamed him for the crisis that has made extremely difficult for Sri Lankans to buy food, fuel, and medicine. The protests have been ongoing since March. The demonstrators say they want a change of the whole governing system. The European Commission presents a gloomy economic forecast for the 27-nation EU. Western sanctions being imposed on Russia are pushing up the cost of living for millions of citizens. Jerome Hughes reports.
The EU's tourism industry is currently thriving, but make no mistake, businesses facing huge overheads are struggling to turn a profit. In its summer economic forecast, the European Commission has revised growth downwards and inflation upwards. The bloc is concerned Russia is going to turn off all its gas supplies.
This risk has become more than just a hypothetical scenario for which we need to prepare. So a storm is possible.
For millions, the storm is already here. Governments are accused of not providing support to deal with the cost of living crisis arising from sanctions against Russia, but can find money for other causes. The EU is providing 9 billion euro to Ukraine to run the country and has sent a separate 2 billion for military equipment. This is in addition to the huge amounts of money being spent on Ukraine by individual member states, most of whom are in NATO, where military spending is also increasing. Not to mention the EU is developing its own army. Citizens say fueling the Ukraine war is costing the EU too much.
It's time to be talking about peace, not about weapons or providing more financial aid to the war.
If the parties could come together and agree a peace, that would be wonderful. But, you know, I'm not sure that's happening, right?
Yes, of course we need to end the war. But the problem is nobody knows how to end the war, you know.
The head of NATO, Jens Stoltenberg, has been facing pressure during a visit to the European Parliament.
NATO, along with the US and the EU, were never a defensive mechanism, not before the war and not after it. They are offensive. Ukraine has been sacrificed for their interests.
Experts warn the growing social crisis in the EU will have dire consequences for the political establishment. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
The U.S. Secret Service has deleted text messages from January 5th and 6th last year after they were asked for by oversight officials investigating the Capitol attack. Now, that is according to the Department of Homeland Security Inspector General that oversees the Secret Service. The Inspector General on Wednesday sent a letter to the House and Senate committees investigating the January 6, 2021 attack. He said that he had requested the messages as part of evaluation of the events on the date, but he said that he was notified that the messages had been deleted as part of a device replacement program. The Secret Service has denied the claim. The development comes as probe continues into the Capitol attack after carried out by supporters of former U.S. President Donald Trump. He has been accused of inciting the violence to remain in power after losing the election. Iran's city of Mashhad has hosted the second edition of Imam Rezam Media Festival. The event is aimed at acknowledging the best media works themed with the Shia Imam Ali ibn Musa Reza, whose shrine is located in Iran's northern city of Mashhad. Yusuf Jaloli reports.
This festival seeks to honor media productions that best introduce Shia Muslims' 8th Imam Reza. Organized by the custodianship of the Holy Shrine of Imam Reza, known as Astan Ghots Razavi, the media festival acknowledges documentary films, news reports, music clips, and motion graphics, among others, themed with the personality of Imam Reza. Imam Reza was born in 766 AD in the Saudi city of Medina. He's one of the descendants of Islam's prophet, Muhammad. Imam Reza holds a special position among Iranians since he spent his last years of life in Iran's city of Mashhad, which was known back then as Tus. This love to the Imam draws millions of his lovers to his magnificently decorated shrine every year.
Imam Reza was a scientist, a religious leader, and a politician during the Abbasid dynasty in the 8th century BC, when the ruler of the time invited him to come to Iran to be the crown prince of the Muslim territory. During his tenure, Imam Reza left a lasting influence on Iranians through his appealing lifestyle. So it's up to us media activists to introduce his amazing character to the world.
Any media work that shines a brighter light on who Imam Reza was is precious in its kind. My work tried to explain the extent of love Iranians have for the 8th Imam, and I'm grateful that it was chosen as one of the best news reports on Imam Reza.
This is the second edition of the Imam Reza Media Festival. Astan Ghots Razavi says so far there's been a rise in the number of works submitted from foreign countries. It hopes that with stronger participation from international media activists, the personality of Imam Reza will be introduced to a wider audience across the world.
Organizers say this festival creates a competitive atmosphere among media activists, and this will help boost the quality of productions themed with Imam Reza. The ultimate goal, they say, is to better introduce the character of the Shia Imam and his instructions to the world. Yusuf Jalali, Mashhad.
And now with that, we come to the end of this edition of World News. Stay tuned.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality, youth, Eastern Tales, roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
Path towards enlightenment.
In the name of God, the All Compassionate, the All Merciful. Salam and welcome to another episode of our weekly series titled Path Towards Enlightenment, which is an endeavor to make you and us familiar with an easy and fluent explanation of God's final scripture to all mankind, the Noble Quran, that was revealed to the last and greatest of all messengers, Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny. Today we complete our explanation of Surah Waqi'ah, that is, the imminent hour or the inevitable event to occur at the end of time. As we have already explained to you, it refers to the day of resurrection, followed by the final judgment, which the disbelievers deny in fear of the sorting out of good and evil, since people on that day will be divided into three classes. Those brought near to the divine threshold for having reached the highest degree of faith, those on the right hand, or ordinary believers who made mistakes but turned in repentance to Allah and thereafter lived a pious life, and those on the left hand, that is, the disbelievers who denied God's message and the prophets, lived in sins and died in the state of disbelief. Ample proof is given in this surah of the infinite power of the Almighty Creator and consequently His ability to bring about the resurrection. If you might recall, in our explanation of the previous ayahs of this surah last week, we said the evolutionary process should make any rational person realize the power of God Almighty to raise the dead to life, especially in view of the fact that the Noble Quran presents the most logical arguments by arguing readers to reflect on the wonders of the world of creation, as well as upon their own selves to attain faith and eventually the bliss of paradise, instead of committing wrongs and plunging into the fires of hell. We also pointed out to the elixir of life, that is, water, which pours down from the clouds to make rivers flow and vegetation to grow, saying that the very power that makes seeds in the soil sprout and become plants is able to raise to life the dead humans on the day of resurrection. In other words, whether it is the development of agriculture or the process of procreation, we human beings might be the instruments of action, but it is the will of God that provides us with a rich variety of crops and the birth of babies and their development into perfect persons blessed with manifold talents. All these ought to inspire us to celebrate the glory of the all-wise Creator and express gratitude to Him instead of being thankless and turning into disbelievers and sinners. Listen to ayahs 75, 76, 77, 78, 79, 80, 81, and 82 of Surah Waqi'ah.
فَلَا أُقْسِمُ بِمَوَاقِعِ النُّجُومِ وَإِنَّهُ لَقَسَمٌ لَوْ تَعْلَمُونَ عَظِيمٌ إِنَّهُ لَقُرْآنٌ كَرِيمٌ في كتاب مكنون لا يمسه إلا المطهرون تنزيل من رب العالمين أفبهذا الحديث أنتم مدهنون وتجعلون رزقكم أنكم تكذبون
ناي I swear by the orbit of the stars, and indeed it is a great oath, should you know. This is indeed a Quran, the most honorable. In a guarded book, the preserved tablets, No one touches it except the pure ones. A revelation gradually sent down from the Lord of all the worlds. What? Do you take lightly this discourse and make your denial of it your vocation or livelihood? These ayahs ascertain the flawless veracity of the Noble Quran, which is indeed an eternal miracle for the guidance of all mankind, granted by the Almighty Creator to His last and greatest messenger, Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny. Ayah 76 is thus a divine oath by emphasis on the places and orbits of the stars, which are billions or more in number, and follow their fixed courses with precision as per the law of gravity without any collision. This makes the oath on the honor, the status of the Quran far more significant. A scientist and any rational person should affirm based on the discoveries of more and more galaxies that remarkably function in an orderly manner, as is evident by our own solar system and its planets, including our wonderful Earth. Without the least doubt, this is a great oath, making an extraordinary announcement that the Quran, to use the Arabic word in the ayah, Karim, or the most honorable, for the bounties it opens for the believers in various paths. Therefore, what has been revealed to the Prophet for the guidance of humanity is preserved in a well-guarded tablet, which means the Noble Quran ought to be touched in the state of cleanliness after due ablution. In order to properly understand its dynamic contents for leading a sound and healthy life away from sins and with enthusiasm for expanding the vistas of knowledge, while only the thoroughly purified ones know its esoteric meanings for further unraveling of the wonders of creation. Ayah 81, pointing to the revelation of the Noble Quran to the Prophet by the Creator of the universe, poses the question in the next ayah on the denial of this manifest truth by the disbelievers and how these deviated persons make a living by continuing to deny facts and realities in order to mislead the ignorant people. From these ayahs, we learn that, number one, divine oath on the wonders of creation is very significant and implies the highly honored status of the Noble Quran, which the Almighty Creator has revealed for the guidance of all mankind by urging them to reflect on its rational and dynamic contents. Number two, the flawless veracity of the Noble Quran is free of any vain discourse or interpolation, and thus, in order to strengthen faith and benefit from its bezels of wisdom, it should be touched in the state of cleanliness and after due ablution. Number three, it is only the Prophet and his purified progeny, Quran, who know the inner meaning of the ayahs of the Noble Quran and thus further open the vistas of knowledge for the seekers of truth. And number four, negligence, trivialization, and denial of the manifest truth of the Noble Quran results from disbelief in the day of resurrection. Now we invite you to listen to ayahs 83, 84, 85, 86, and 87 of the same surah.
فَلَوْلَا إِذَا بَلَغَتِ الْحُلْقُومَ وَأَنْتُمْ حِينَئِذٍ تَنْظُرُونَ وَنَحْنُ أَقْرَبُ إِلَيْهِ مِنْكُمْ وَلَكِنْ لَا تُبْصِرُونَ فلولا إن كنتم غير مدينين ترجعونها إن كنتم صادقين.
So when it, the soul leaving the body, reaches the throat of the dying person, while you are looking on, and we are nearer to him than you are, though you do not perceive, then why do you not, if you are not subject to the divine dispensation, restore it? Should you be truthful? These ayahs hint at God's power of resurrection by pointing to the last moments of a person's life when none can avert death, which is decreed by the Almighty Creator, who is nearer to every one of us than our own selves. Although most do not realize this fact, owing to their fickle faith or lack of faith. The intention here is to awaken the conscience of the helpless onlookers who are also destined to meet the same fate. Despite modern sophisticated technical and medical equipment, which cannot compensate human weakness, thereby exposing the liars and deniers who doubt resurrection and the Day of Judgment. These ayahs teach us the following points. Number one, the power that gave life and decreed death can resurrect the dead from rotten and powdered bones for the final judgment. And number two, no one, including modern scientific technology, have the power to avert death, let alone restoring the death to life. Now, in conclusion of this week's episode of Path Towards Enlightenment, which also marks completion of Surah Waqia, we present you ayahs 88, 89, 90, 91, 92, 93, 94, 95, and 96.
فَأَمَّا إِن كَانَ مِنَ الْمُقَرَّبِينَ فروح وريحان وجنة نعيم وأما إن كان من أصحاب اليمين فسلام لك من أصحاب اليمين وأما إن كان من المكذبين الضالين فنزل من حميم وتصلية جحيم إن هذا لهو حق اليقين فسبح باسم ربك العظيم.
Then, if he be of those brought near to the divine threshold, then ease, abundance, and a garden of bliss. And if he be of the people of the right hand, then greeting to you from the people of the right hand. But if he be of the deniers, the astray ones, then a treat of boiling water, an entry into hell. Indeed, this is the certain truth. So celebrate the name of your Lord, the All Supreme. These ayahs sum up the points discussed in the beginning of the surah, which classifies people into three categories on Resurrection Day on the basis of differing human dispositions at the time of death. Thus, those destined to be near the divine threshold pass away with utmost serenity, peace of mind, and happiness for the abundant bliss of paradise. Those on the right hand also attain felicity and the company of the virtuous in heaven, for having died with faith after repentance in the divine court and seeking of forgiveness from the all-merciful Lord. And for the disbelievers, the deniers of truth, and the unrepentant sinners, death opens up for them the gates of horrible punishment, with boiling water and fall into the fires of hell. This is indeed the undeniable truth. and we should therefore celebrate the name of the Lord Most High. These ayahs teach us that, number one, people are generally scared of death, but for those who are firm of faith and have abstained from sins, or those who have repented of their misdeeds and become righteous, death brings for them great bounties, including the bliss of paradise. And number two, as for the disbelievers and unrepentant sinners, the moment the soul leaves the physical body, the never-ending torment begins.
Us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story. In
what is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
The war in Yemen has experienced a back-to-back truce, a badly needed one, given the humanitarian catastrophe in that country. So bad that the Red Cross has said that two-thirds of Yemenis are deprived of basic health care in unimaginable horror. Well, in this edition of The Spotlight, we will look at this unimaginable horror, the U.S. complicity in this war. And even though the truce has been broken by the Saudis on more than one occasion, the reports that the U.S. may continue arms sales to the kingdom. Our guests joining us for this edition of The Spotlight are journalist and political analyst Yusuf Mowry, who joins us from Sana'a. Also joining us, the founder and editor of the independent news website, Multipolarista, Ben Norton, who joins us from Managua.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Welcome to you both. Ben Norton, let me first start with you. We are looking at the fact that you have a humanitarian situation unfolding in the degree that it is. That's no surprise. But given at this point, we're talking about how the Red Cross says unimaginable horror and that two-thirds of Yemeni people are deprived of basic health care, why hasn't there been any headway made in that arena, given the fact that we're looking at somewhat of a truce that's now been held back-to-back? We're looking at 4 months of it now, roughly.
Well, the answer is because it's in the strategic interests of the West to continue this war after more than 6 years now. We see that the Joe Biden administration is trying to improve its relations with Saudi Arabia and essentially telling Riyadh that it's going to be able to continue waging this war. Now, Joe Biden has repeatedly claimed he wants to end the war, but the reality is that it's in the West's continued interest to support Saudi Arabia's war on Yemen and continue providing weapons and military support. And of course, if this were another country waging war on Yemen, like Russia, I think there would be an international outrage that was led by the West. But because it's the West that's backing this war in Yemen, and because the U.S. dominates media narratives and uses its political power to pressure other countries into silence, there's very little discussion of the fact that the people in Yemen are suffering from the worst humanitarian catastrophe on Earth. According to the United Nations, more than 370,000 Yemenis have died in this war, and that's a conservative estimate. And again, we have to ask why. Well, the answer is very clear. It's because the West is backing this war, and according to the West, anything that they want to do is supposedly justified.
Well, you're there, Yusuf Mary, in Sana'a, and when you take a look at the way that Yemenis speak about the West, as our guest there talks about, what West are they referring to that's basically unleashed through the Saudi-led coalition the horrors that is unfolding? Do they blame Saudi Arabia only? Do they blame the U.S.? Who are they blaming?
All of the above. That's who the Yemeni people are blaming. In fact, the international community, any country that is not speaking out against the Saudi coalition and U.S.'s continuous propensity to want to expand over, even if it means spilling the blood of tens of thousands of innocent people, any country that's not speaking out or is remaining silent to the genocide that's taken place in Yemen, that's what the Yemeni people are blaming, but primarily Saudi Arabia, and of course its U.S. allies, right? You have Saudi Arabia, who's been receiving billions and billions of dollars worth of military aid from the U.S., and the Yemeni people have experienced the reality of what those weapons, what the repercussion of Saudi Arabia having those weapons is going to be, and that's going to lead into the death of tens of thousands of more innocent Yemenis. So again, to answer your question, anybody who's not speaking out against Saudi Arabia, against the U.S. for its continuous atrocities on Yemen, they should be held accountable and they should be blamed, right? Also, the U.N., the U.N. Security Council, any U.N. entity that's, I was here last week and, we did an interview about the humanitarian crisis in the country. And, we're throwing numbers of tens of thousands of innocent people dying, thousands and thousands of innocent children starving to death because of the blockade. And you have, Amnesty International, you have the International Red Cross, the U.N. all speaking out and, basically proclaiming that they want to help alleviate the humanitarian crisis. But that's not the fact. That's not the reality, because all they really want to do is, use the case, the humanitarian case in Yemen, to justify, making money, to justify getting donations from their sponsors, their donors. If they really wanted to end the suffering in Yemen, they would call on Saudi Arabia, call on the UN to lift the strangling blockade. The people are starving on the ground because of the blockade. Basic necessities is not able to enter the country. That's not because the Yemeni people are poor. That's not because Yemen doesn't have enough natural resources to feed its people. It's simply because there's an insidious blockade being imposed by the U.S., by the U.N., and the international community, who are turning a blind eye to the atrocities that are taking place. When you look at what's happening in Ukraine, on the other hand, Amnesty International, the U.N., every country has condemned Russia, and they're claiming this is a Russian invasion, and Russia is killing innocent people, and Russia is doing this and is doing that. Not one of these entities is holding Saudi Arabia accountable. Not one of these nations or these entities is pointing the finger at the crown prince or the king of Saudi Arabia to tell him enough is enough.
Indeed. Well, when you look at it through that lens that our guests are from Sana'a just talked about there, Ben Orton, it shows U.N. complicity. And the only thing that comes to my mind is how Saudi Arabia, along with the U.S., are major contributors when it comes to the funding of the U.N. We've known about how Saudi Arabia has actually been excused by the U.N. when it came to killing children in the war in Yemen and countless of other situations where, they made excuses for Saudi Arabia. And, of course, this sheds another light and another angle to this. Do you think that that is the reason, if you agree with our guest there from Sana'a, that perhaps even the U.N. is complicit because this siege is not being lifted and people in Yemen are still suffering?
Well, we do know that the pressure of funding has been a significant factor in the United Nations inaction. In fact, the previous Secretary General Ban Ki-moon admitted that Saudi Arabia threatened to withdraw funding after the UN was going to put Saudi Arabia on its list of countries that violate the rights of children. So it's an objective fact that Saudi Arabia and the Western powers have used funding as blackmail to try to prevent the United Nations from taking action against this borderline genocidal war in Yemen. But we also know that inside the United Nations Security Council, which is the institution that has the most power, the U.S. has very frequently used its veto power to prevent any U.N. action. So I think it's very justified to criticize the U.N., but at the end of the day, the weaknesses of the U.N., I think, are reflections of Western imperialism and U.S. hegemony. The fact that the U.S. can use the U.N. to advance its geopolitical interests, and then when the U.N. tries to take actions that may in some way challenge U.S. interests, well, Washington can use its veto in the Security Council to block those resolutions. We've seen the United States many dozens of times has vetoed UN resolutions condemning apartheid Israel's illegal activities and occupation of Palestinian territories. So similarly, if the UN Security Council were to try to take action against Saudi Arabia's war in Yemen, it's very likely that the United States and also potentially Britain and France would use their veto power to prevent any UN action against Saudi Arabia. So once again, Riyadh can only carry out this war and kill hundreds of thousands of Yemenis because it has support from Western imperialist powers. And honestly, if the United States were to say tomorrow, we are ending our support for this war, I think the war would end within a few days. But the response from the White House is, of course, the opposite. Instead, Joe Biden is saying, well, we want to improve our relations with Saudi Arabia in order to continue our war on Russia as well. So in Washington, the solution to all of these problems is never less war. It's always more war.
Well, let me open up then this question, which I'm almost sure that maybe you have either read it, Yusuf Mari, or you've heard about it at this point. And that is the op-ed that Biden, the U.S. president, has written prior to his visit to the region, titled Why He's Going to Saudi Arabia. I mean, there in itself shows the level of, I don't want to say disillusion, because obviously either Biden wrote it himself or somebody wrote it for him. But it really is a far stretch from the reality. And I begin with this, Yusuf Mari, where Biden says, the war in Yemen was escalating, creating one of the world's worst humanitarian crises with no political process. In Yemen, I named an envoy and engaged with leaders across the region, including the King of Saudi Arabia, to lay the foundation for a truce. What do you think when the U.S. president is saying that?
Well, he's obviously pushing the U.S.'s political agenda, and he's going to say whatever he's going to say to push that agenda. I mean, you have a president who's ignoring the death and the genocide of tens of thousands of innocent people in order to pursue and to continue the Western hegemonic international structure, right? And that's been the case. Biden, he's scheduled to visit Saudi Arabia in the next couple of days. And the reason why he's doing that is, the U.S. has a propensity to beef up its allies with military weapons in order to continue Western expansion and in order to continue the U.S.'s interest dominance over the region. But what's interesting about this visit, this visit actually, is that the U.S. and Israel, they're actually laying the groundwork for a new security alliance to be established between the U.S., between Israel, and most of the Arab states, most of the Saudi-backed coalition. And the purpose of this visit is they want to create or connect military technology to combat Yemen. They're actually building a network of radars, detectors, weapon interceptors, and they want to use this military technology, unprecedented military technology, to attack Yemen on demand. And not only attack Yemen, but they also want to counter any missile attacks by the Sana'a government towards Saudi Arabia or toward any of the countries that are waging this aggression on Yemen. And what's even more interesting is that the U.S. and the Israeli entity, they're actually using Yemeni islands, they're using Yemeni territory to build these military bases, to build these detectors, to build these sophisticated state-of-the-art radars They're using the island of Socotra. They're using the island of Meitun. And this is all Yemeni land that's being used to point its weapons and to point its missiles towards the Yemeni people. So this is an unprecedented event where you have a, you know, just think of NATO joining forces with the Arab coalition being led by the Israeli entity and the U.S. supreme military technology all joining forces to wage war on Yemen. This is, you know, this is not propaganda. This is actually happening
Indeed.
As we speak. So as we speak, in spite of the humanitarian crisis that's taking place on the ground, you have more military activity in preparation to wage an all-out war on Yemen. And from the looks of it, it's going to happen in the near future.
Mm-hmm. We're going to discuss that a little bit more. I need to open this op-ed more because it's really incredible, Ben Norton, when you think about it. Another very controversial statement coming out of it, in a sense, is how the U.S. president says, after a year of our persistent diplomacy, this truce is now in place. News just came out today, exclusively, of course, internal U.S. discussions on Saudi arms at early stage, decision likely to depend on Saudi efforts to end the war. So you have the U.S. announcing potential arms sales. Biden did sell arms back in November of 2021 to the tune of between $650 to $750 million. So how do you evaluate the way that Biden is presenting himself in this op-ed with this last viewpoint that I just presented?
Well, it's more of the same. Joe Biden claimed repeatedly during his presidential campaign that he would end the war in Yemen. And when he came in January of 2021, then in February, a few weeks after entering office, he claimed that he had reached a new agreement with Saudi Arabia and he was ending support for all offensive operations. Now, he claimed that the U.S. was continuing support for Saudi defensive operations. But of course, the very nature of the Saudi war is an aggressive war. It is a war that was launched in March 2015, bombing Saudi Arabia's southern neighbor, Yemen. And Saudi Arabia, with the support of the U.S., Britain, and France, has carried out tens of thousands of airstrikes. How can an airstrike be defensive? It's not defensive. So we see that from the very beginning, the Biden administration has been the master of trying to use this language that sounds like he's ending the war, that sounds like he's pursuing peace and diplomacy, but all he's really doing is redefining what the U.S. is doing in supporting Saudi Arabia and its war in Yemen, and then saying that he made progress. And similarly now, he says that he's going to pressure Saudi Arabia to end the war in Yemen and then going to start selling offensive weapons. Are we really supposed to believe that if Saudi Arabia says, oh, we're ending the war in Yemen, but we buy all of these weapons from the U.S., are we really supposed to believe that Saudi Arabia is not going to use those weapons? Then why is it buying those weapons? It's clearly buying those weapons with the intent to use them. And maybe Saudi Arabia says, okay, we have officially ended operations, and then it unofficially continues waging this war. And we also have to be clear, when Biden says that Saudi Arabia is going to engage in diplomacy, does that mean that it's going to recognize the de facto government in Yemen that governs the majority of where the population of Yemen lives, which is the Sana'a government? Is Saudi Arabia ever going to recognize that government? And of course, the answer is very unlikely. Saudi Arabia is still going to recognize the puppet regime, which was unelected in the south, as the illegitimate government of Yemen. So that's not a diplomatic solution. That's just kicking the problem under the rug and pretending like it no longer exists.
Okay, let's break this down with the information you gave us, Yusuf Mowry. We're looking at the Socotra Island, where it is reported that the UAE is setting up a military base with Israeli cooperation and perhaps to have Israeli special operatives operating there along with the UAE. What type of purpose does that serve, and what are they doing to execute whatever military purposes they believe it serves them? If you can please explain that to us.
Well, they basically, so here's how it works in Yemen, right? With what's been, you know, has been empirically proven. The U.S., Israel, Saudi Arabia, they've come to the realization that they will not win the war inside of Yemen. In other words, they understand that they will not be able to topple, they will not be able to dethrone the Sana'a government from power because, one, the Sana'a government has a large portion of support from the Yemeni people, and they've managed to win the hearts and minds of the majority of the Yemeni people. They've tried over the past 7 years to overthrow, to dethrone the Sana'a government, and they failed miserably across the board to achieve this goal. So now, plan B, if you will, they will no longer try to take over the capital Sana'a. What they're going to do instead, actually, they're going to try to turn Yemen into another Gaza, whereby Yemen as a nation will be imprisoned. It will be besieged and surrounded with military bases to wage attack on demand anytime that they feel the need to do so. So just because they can't overthrow the government and just because they can't win the hearts and the minds of the Yemeni people, they're resorting to Plan B, which calls for the engulfing the entire nation with military bases and waging attacks anytime the Yemeni government, the Sana'a government, attempts to resuscitate the economy, anytime the Yemeni government attempts to rebuild its military and public institutions. They're basically hell-bent on keeping Yemen in the worst humanitarian crisis until they get the regime change that they want. So unless the U.S. and Israel and Saudi Arabia get the regime change that they so desperately want, they're going to keep the Yemeni people starving to death. They're going to keep this strangling blockade imposed on the country. They're going to continue their airstrikes. They're going to continue their military offensive from all four corners of Yemen. And this is what the Socotra Island is being used for. This is what the island of Ma'un is being used for. This is what the north, west, south is being used for in Yemen. Any place in Yemen, any area that's under the occupation of Saudi Arabia and its mercenaries is going to be used to continue waging this Saudi war on Yemen. And to answer your question, so this is what the plan is right now. Since they can't take over Yemen, since they can't get the regime change that they want, they're basically hell-bent on turning Yemen into another Gaza. They basically want it to be a country without a thriving economy. They basically want Yemen to be without a military, and they want the country to be divided and in a state of chaos and instability.
When you want to break down the amount of incentive each entity has in this game, Ben Norton, I'm sorry, I shouldn't use the word game, in this process, we're looking at the United States, Saudi Arabia, obviously, and we're also looking, obviously, in the increasing role that Israel plays. It appears that the U.S. may be outnumbered when it comes to an incentive to have the scenario that our guest from Sana'a says to be executed, because even if Saudi Arabia, even if the U.S. does not want to pursue this war, Israel is pushing for that scenario that our guest from Sana'a is saying. I'm sure that you have Saudi Arabia that perhaps maybe even laying out that as a condition in order for the situation or the relationship between Saudi Arabia and the U.S. to improve, and arms sales being one of those prerequisites of Saudi Arabia. Is that a possibility?
Well, I think so, but the reality is that for the United States, they, speaking frankly, unfortunately, the United States government does not care about the people of Yemen. It never has. It was waging a drone war that killed many Yemeni civilians. The Trump administration carried out raids that killed Yemeni children. The U.S. government sees Yemen as a chip in a game. I mean, you use the term game. Unfortunately, that's the way these policymakers in Washington see the world. They see countries not as countries representing sovereign people of flesh and blood, they see the countries as potential allies or enemies. And George W. Bush famously said that the perspective of the U.S. government is you're either with us or you're against us. And the U.S. government is trying to force every country around the world to join its alliance in a new Cold War that it's waging on both China and Russia. And of course, Iran is a strategic partner of both China and Russia. And that further incentivizes the U.S. and apartheid Israel to work together to pressure all countries in West Asia to take aggressive actions against Iran, to try to isolate Iran and also, of course, isolate China and Russia. So unfortunately, in terms of what U.S. interests are, the U.S. has no interest whatsoever in protecting the Yemeni people. The Joe Biden administration may claim for public relations purposes and you know, its public speeches that it cares about human rights. But I'm sure that when Biden sits down with Mohammed bin Salman, he's going to say very clearly, look, we're against Iran, we're against China, we're against Russia. You just have to do something publicly to get all of these people criticizing me off of my back. He's going to tell MBS that you should say that you formally ended the war, and we're going to continue as you informally continue this war. And I think the guest from Sana'a is correct that the U.S. strategy is to turn Yemen into a new Gaza and to try to get everyone around the world to just forget about it. Okay. And allow Saudi Arabia to continue occupying it, blockading it, and continuing a